Okay, so the amazing thing is that these people working from 1789 until 1900 roughly figured out all about atoms and molecules and bonds and how reactions take place, at least something about that. Much of mechanism in organic chemistry happened during the 20th century, as we'll see. But as far as structure goes, they figured it all out with very, very crude tools, as you'll see, and a lot of mistakes, of course, and a lot of clever analysis. So it started the chemical revolution with the Traité élémentaire de chimie by Lavoisier in 1789. And you remember, it's presented in a new order, he said. The first part of the book was doctrine, he called it, then nomenclature, and then operations. So this meant ideas, the theory, the words that were used to express it, and the facts, the new facts that were determined experimentally. Okay, so the facts, almost all of this stuff was figured out through analysis. Now, analysis, the Oxford English Dictionary says, comes from two Greek roots, ana, which means up or back, and luein, which means to loose. So it's to loose, to take things apart, right? So it says the resolution or breaking up of anything complex into its various simple elements. So the idea was to find out what the pieces were that matter was made of. And it's the opposite of synthesis, which is to put things together. It's the exact determination of the elements or components of anything complex. So the elements or the components. Now, it says specifically in chemistry, the resolution of a chemical compound into its proximate or ultimate elements. Now, ultimate means as far as you can go. Remember, that's what Lavoisier said his elements would be, as far as you could go with analysis. So the example OED gives is 1791, that says the quantity of charcoal which they yield by analysis. So you take some stuffs and see how much charcoal is in it. That's carbon, of course. But proximate analysis says in 1831 here, sugar, starch, and gum are proximate principles, and these we obtain by proximate analysis. Where do you see proximate analyses in your daily life? Yeah. What, pardon me?
Cooking.
Yeah. But you can read it out. You don't read it out so often in cooking. And cooking is, I would say, more often a matter of synthesis, but I suppose that's a matter of taste, maybe. Okay. Where do you see proximate analyses? How much fat? How much protein? How much sugar? You see it on candy bars and stuff, right? Or cookies or foodstuffs in general. That's proximate analysis. Ultimate analysis is to see how much of each of the elements is in something. So in the Traité élémentaire de chimie, there's fact and theory and words. So for example, here's the table of simple substances. So remember, the simplest substances are said to be light and caloric. Now, with respect to caloric, he had interesting things to say. He said the word gas is thus for us a generic name that designates the ultimate degree of saturation of whatever substance by caloric. Would you agree with that? What's he saying?
Gas is just the general term we give to a substance with varying degrees of heat and energy.
Yeah.
Well, like, if you heat something up, it eventually becomes gas. And I think it's like the highest energy.
Yeah, if you put enough heat to it, it'll become a gas. Okay, some things are gases already at normal temperature. Some things you have to heat up to make them into a gas, things like water. Okay, so a gas is caloric plus some base, some radical, some root of something. The element itself plus caloric is a gas. But they're different gases depending on what you're dealing with. Okay. And then the next one is oxygen, which has a number of old names. He's giving it this new name. Now, why does he give it this new name? Why doesn't he call it imperial air or vital air, or the base of vital air? He says, we have given to the base of the portion of air that supports respiration the name oxygen, deriving it from two Greek words, oxus, acid, and genomai, to cause to be. Because, in fact, one of the most general properties of this base is forming acids by combining with most substances. We shall thus call oxygen gas the combination of this base with caloric. Right? The base is oxygen, because why do they call it oxygen? Because it makes things into acids. It makes other bases into acids. Whoops, what's going on here? I don't know what that is. Okay. So, oxygen plus a base or radical becomes an acid. Okay. Here are some examples of oxidable and acidifiable simple substances that are not metals. So sulfur, phosphorus, charcoal. Oxidized sulfur, you get sulfuric acid. Oxidized phosphorus, you get phosphoric acid. Oxidized charcoal, you get carbonic acid. Right? And then azote. Right? He says, since the chemical properties of the part of atmospheric air that does not support respiration were not well known, we were content to deduce the name of its base from the property of its gas to take the life of animals that breathed it. What does he mean? Yeah. If you put a mouse in pure nitrogen, it loses its life, right? We have named it azote from the Greek privative, that means taken away, right? A, and zoe, life. Thus, the unbreathable part of air would be azotic gas. And of course, we call it what? Nitrogen, most of the atmosphere, right? And in fact, he foresaw that, although my clicking here, I missed the statement. I'll put it back in. He actually suggested the name nitrogen because it also becomes nitre. If you oxidize it, it becomes nitre, nitric acid. So he said you could call it nitrogen. Okay? Or hydrogen. We find ourselves forced to give a name. Nothing seems more convenient to us than hydrogen, that is to say, the generating principle of water, from hidor, water, and genomai again, to cause to be. We shall call the combinate of this principle with caloric hydrogen gas, with caloric hydrogen gas, and the word hydrogen alone will stand for the base of the simple gas, the radical of water. Okay, so oxygen plus a base or a radical gives an acid. Okay, so if you have an acid, there must be some base that it came from through interaction with oxygen. So for example, think of these radicals, the muriatic radical, which would upon oxidation give rise to what? What would muriatic radical give if you oxidized it? It's an element, right? What if you oxidize it? Gives what acid? Muriatic acid, obviously. Does anybody know what muriatic acid is? It's hydrochloric acid, right? Notice that radical is unknown. Why do you think it was unknown when the ones of sulfur, phosphorus, charcoal obviously were known and on oxidation gave sulfuric, phosphoric, yeah? Pardon me? Would chlorine gas upon oxidation give hydrochloric acid? No, there is no oxygen in hydrochloric acid. Right? So you didn't have everything right. Right? But he had this general theory, the oxygen theory of acid, that you have a base, you react it with oxygen, you get the corresponding acid. So that was unknown, and it never became known, the base of muriatic acid, in the sense of you oxidize it and it becomes the corresponding acid. But there were also other radicals. Radicals, that is roots, bases of things, that involved more than one element. It was known that these things had hydrogen in them, that they had oxygen in them, that they had carbon in them. Right? They were compound, but still they were radicals, which upon oxidation would become acids. Right? So look at some of the list of his compound radicals. Things like tartaric, citric, oxalic, benzoic, lactic. Have you ever seen those before? Where? Those were Scheele's acids that he had purified, right? Also lithic, which came from kidney stones. Okay? Okay, so then there were different oxidation states. There were different amounts of oxygen that an element, a base, a radical could add. So in this table, the first column is what radical you're dealing with. Like caloric can be the radical. You oxidize it with the element oxygen, and you get oxygen gas. Right? So the first column, the first degree of oxidation is not indeed an acid. It's an oxide. Right? So there are things like tin oxide halfway down there, gray oxide of tin. Right? But then if you add more oxygen, you get an acid, which he gave the suffix us, O-U-S. And if you add more, what do you get? Ick. Right? And if you add more, you get oxygenated ick acid. Right? So there are these different levels of oxidation. And he's the guy that thought up these suffixes that you use when you say hydrochlorous acid or something like that. That's Lavoisier speaking. Pardon me? That's for a salt. Right? This is the acid. He also thought up those names, ite and ate, for the salts that come. He thought up names of salts too. And he had the idea that a salt would be an acid plus a base, right? So you'd have, and one of you, so the name would be something ate or something ite, right? So the idea of giving two names for those things was Lavoisier's. Okay, but notice how risky this prediction was, because an awful lot of these things were unknown. In fact, there's no single row that has all the oxidation states in it, right? So it's hard to think exactly how he got into this idea of being sure that there were all these things. Okay, now, he had to do analysis, and so these were experiments he did. Remember, he had a lot of money, so he could build a big experiment. Here's a scale of feet down there. That's, 4 feet or something like that. So this is a big thing, right? So on the left, there are two barrels, a right-side-up barrel, and inside it an upside-down barrel, and there's water there. And he's got a thing that can raise or lower the top one. So if you lower it, you generate pressure in the air inside it. Then there's a tube that comes up inside, and the air will come out the tube down here. And then it'll go through this thing here. Now, he needed a lot of air to combust a lot of oil, right? So more air than there would be in that thing. So how's he going to get more air? He has two of them. Right, so he's got a stopcock here, and he can a three-way stopcock. He can turn it one way or the other. Right, so he takes the air out of that one, and then he starts the other one going, and takes the air from that while he raises the first one, then raises the second one. So he's got a continuous supply of air. Okay, so the air comes down this tube and through here, and through this, which is a drying tube, right? Because it's coming from water. So now you got dry air coming through this tube and down into here. And here, well, here there is a lamp. But here there is oil. That's what he's going to find out, how much carbon is in it and how much hydrogen is in it. Right? So he's got a siphon here, right, that feeds a lamp, right, that's also getting air from this supply system. So you got a flame here, and the products of combustion go up and down this tube and up through here. What's that for? To collect water, right? So any hydrogen becomes water. So some of the water drips down into here, and he weighs it. And there'll be some that doesn't get condensed, and it'll get caught in this tube. So you weigh this jar and that tube before and after, and you see how much hydrogen there was in the oil that burned. Okay? And then it goes in here, blows into here, and there's a hook here with a little knob on top. So someone is standing there twisting this knob back and forth to stir that thing. Can you guess what's in there? What does he want to find? Carbon. What form is the carbon in? Carbon dioxide, yeah. Not water. Well, it would dissolve somewhat in water, but it's much better to do something else. You put a base in there that changes it into a salt so that it doesn't come out of the water again. So you use calcium hydroxide, lime water. Do you ever see lime water? Blow into lime water, it gets all white and cloudy. Okay, that's... Okay, so he did that, and some of it wouldn't get caught, and it would come up here and go into the next one. So the person who was stirring it would have to use both hands and stir both of them constantly while this thing is going, right? Okay, then he's got this, so that's the CO2 collector. And then he's got another tube here. Can you guess what that's for? He's going to weigh these before and after to see how much CO2 collected. Can you think of any problem he might encounter? You're blowing gas through this thing, so what's going to happen? Some of the water's going to go out, so you're going to be losing weight at the same time you're adding weight. So what do? You put another drying tube in. It'll catch the water that came out. So now you weigh this and this and this before and after, and then you get how much CO2 came out. So if you know how much weight of CO2 corresponds to how much weight of carbon, then you know how much carbon was there. If you know how much weight of water corresponds to how much hydrogen, then you know how much hydrogen there was in the oil that got burned. Okay? Pretty clever, but it's pretty laborious. So you got one guy who's running the air pump, right, raising these barrels and letting them down again. Somebody else who's siphoning the oil at the right rate so it doesn't overflow the lamp or run out. And somebody adjusting the wick. There are tools here for adjusting the wick on the lamp so it keeps burning. Somebody who's sitting there doing this. So, you know, it takes three men and a boy to run this thing. Right? But after a while, you can measure how much stuff is. In fact, it's not obvious that he ever used this. The instrument still exists, but it was built at the time that he had other things on his mind too, right? And then lost his head. Okay, how would you analyze a substance if it didn't burn cleanly? You know, sometimes when things burn, they give soot. Right? Or don't burn at all, like sugar, if you try to burn it, it doesn't burn. Okay, like grape sugar, the suc de raisin. Okay, so here in chapter 13, he addresses that, and he says everybody knows how wine and cider and mead and other sorts of fermented beverages, spiritual beverages, are made. Right? How do you make them? Yeah, you ferment the stuff, right? So he has a fermentation apparatus, much like the previous one, where you put the sugar you want to analyze or with yeast and water, right? And then it starts fermenting and you have something to catch the foam. Did you ever see a vat in which stuff was fermenting? You had all this foam all over. So you got a foam catcher so that doesn't get into your apparatus. And then a thing that absorbs H2O, because you don't want to measure that. Right? What you want to measure is the CO2 that comes out from the sugar, which is absorbed in sodium hydroxide solution in this case. And any gas that's left over comes and collects in that bell jar. Right? So you can analyze how much carbon there is in the sugar in this way, even though it was impossible to burn it. And he says then about fermentation, that it can furnish a way of analyzing sugar. Okay? So oxidation had failed when he tried to use air or oxygen or sulfuric acid or mercuric oxide, other sources of oxygen, because the stuff charred. But he says, I can consider the materials subjected to fermentation and the products of fermentation as an algebraic equation. This is the idea of the conservation of mass, right? However much you start with, you end with. Okay, and by in turn supposing each of the elements of this equation to be unknown, I can derive a value and thus correct experiment by calculation and calculation by experiment. So what does he mean by that? Yeah. So what do you do with your experimental numbers? You adjust them if it doesn't quite match, right? Okay? I have often profited from this way of correcting the preliminary results of my experiments. Right? This is early days in doing quantitative analysis. Okay, so he was a bookkeeper. You know, he worked with his father-in-law in the Ferme Générale, which collected taxes and so on. He ran his estates and so on. So he was accustomed to doing proper bookkeeping. So he did the same thing with elements. So he has all these tables where he does bookkeeping to keep track of the balance of the elements. So he reports things in pounds and ounces and gros and grains. So he's going down to very fine, you know, to the centime here, right? Because there's 72 grains in a grow and 8 grows in an ounce, which is 28 grams. So he's got less than a five, but I, you know, a very small part of a gram, you know, down to 10 milligrams out of 400 pounds. He's measuring these things. It's going to make it balance. Okay? So here's the table two is the proximate analysis, right? How much water, how much sugar, and how much dry yeast. Notice that yeast, he knew, has water in it. So if you want to know how much water is there, you have to take how much yeast you have and add this water to this water in order to know how much water you have altogether. Okay, so anyhow, he's a certain amount of water, certain amount of sugar, certain amount of dry yeast at the beginning, right? Or he could recalculate it according to the ultimate analysis. How much oxygen, hydrogen, charcoal, that is carbon, and nitrogen, there was in the sum of everything he started with. So there's a certain amount of pounds, ounces, grow, and grains. Well, notice he goes to 1.36 grains. So that's down to milligrams, right? Okay, so in all he starts with 510 pounds altogether, exactly. Okay? And then this is the products he gets at the end after the fermentation. So they're the proximate constituents. Carbonic acid, that's the CO2 that he collected, water, dry alcohol, dry acetic acid, sugar, dry yeast, right? Each of those he had analyzed before, so he knows how much oxygen, charcoal, water, and so on. So he can rewrite a table 5 in which he does it in terms of the elements at the end. So he has a certain amount of oxygen, certain amount of charcoal, certain amount of hydrogen and of nitrogen, and the total here, if you compare the start and the end in terms of the elements, he started with 510 pounds, 0 ounces, 0 grow, 0 grains, and he ended with 510 pounds, right? 0 ounces, 0 grow, 0 grains. So Price Waterhouse would be very happy, right? The books balance exactly. Do you think that this is a fair reflection of what he actually observed? No way. Right? But he knew that this is what should happen, so he made it happen. Right? If you do this in lab, what happens? They come down on you, like my father-in-law used to say, like a duck on a June bug. Right? Because this is not the right way to do experiments. Okay? Okay, so now he had to know how much carbon corresponded to how much carbon dioxide. Right, because he measured carbon dioxide and wanted to find out how much carbon. So how did he find that out? He found it out with this experiment. Okay, so here's a tube that passes through a fire, red-hot glass tube, and he connects to it. Inside the tube there are 28 grains of carbon, right, charcoal. Okay, which the fire does nothing to that, it just sits there, okay. 1.38 grams of carbon. Okay, and then he takes water in this flask over here and he builds a fire and heats it and it distills and condenses over on the other side after passing through the tube. But did you notice what else happened as it went through the tube? The charcoal disappeared. Right? So at the end, there's no more 28 grams of carbon in there, or 28 grains, I mean, 1.38 grams, right? And there's not as much water as there was at the beginning either. It's come short by 87.5 grains. Okay? So where did the extra carbon and water go? And incidentally, you might wonder whether he could really measure that the amount of water was 85.7 grains less than it was at the beginning. Okay, for the same reason that we worry about his fermentation results. Okay, Well, what he found was that gas came out the end. That he got 144 cubic inches, that is 100 grains of carbonic gas, and 380 cubic inches, or 13.7 grains of flammable gas. What's flammable gas? Hydrogen. So he got CO2 and hydrogen, as we know now. Okay, so it must be that that amount of carbonic gas and that amount of hydrogen, right, were equal to how much you lost in terms of carbon and water coming across. So that's how he knew so accurately how much. Okay, because he knew the equation, that you had the same amount at the start and at the end. Okay, now, if you calculate on the basis of what we know now, if you had 28 grains of carbon, how much CO2 do you get out of it? And from the if that oxygen that goes in there comes from water, how much hydrogen you get? You should get those amounts. You should get 157 cubic inches, not 144. You should get 380 cubic inches, not 313, not 380. So, you know, that's not his fault. I mean, it was hard to do accurate experiments in those days. But the important thing to notice is how he twisted things in order to make them agree with what he was trying to prove, which is that the elements are conserved in the process. Okay, and he said in connection with this experiment, I have thought it best to correct by calculation and to present the experiment in all its simplicity. So he wasn't perfect. But he certainly did a lot, and he started things on the right track, primarily by being really clear about things, about emphasizing this, that there are facts and ideas and words, and they have to all tie together if you're going to make a logical edifice. Okay, so with respect to facts, he devised and built and showed other people how to build lots of different kinds of apparatus. He measured things quantitatively. In particular, he focused on mass. There were other things you could have focused on. You could have focused on the color of things, that maybe color is preserved as you go through reactions. Or it could be volume or any property, you know, density could be preserved or something, but what he focused on was mass, and subsidiarily on volume, which of course required that he measure the density of gases, which we showed last time how he did. He did some stuff with new substances. He's given credit for discovering oxygen, but in fact he wasn't the first at that. And there were some reactions that he recognized, but that wasn't his primary contribution in terms of facts. In terms of ideas, the clear definition of what an element was, as far as you can go in analysis. If you ever are able to go farther, okay, there are other elements. The thing you were looking at was compound. Conservation of mass was a big contribution, even though his experiments didn't prove it down to the final decimal points, right? The idea of oxidation, the oxygen theory of acids, the idea that you have a radical and you make it into an acid with oxygen, and the idea of salts as a grouping of two things, an acid and a non-acid. Okay. And then in terms of words, to give things meaningful names like oxygen, hydrogen, which you notice are related to this oxygen theory that he had. Okay, so the meaningful names for the elements, for oxidation states, so these us, ick, are his suffixes, and salt composition, so ide and ite and ate, all these are his names. So that it was clear when you named something what kind of thing you were naming. But, like all great minds in any time, he lacked imagination. I mean, he had imagination to an extraordinary degree, but everybody lacks imagination, and they always have done so. So he said at the end of this preface to this book, this most important book, chemistry's present progress, however, is so rapid, and the facts under the modern doctrine have assumed so happy an arrangement that we have ground to hope, even in our own times, to see it approach near the highest state of perfection of which it is susceptible. people. So we're almost there. We've got the theory in place. If we just make a few more measurements and tweak things a little bit, we're there. That's what people have always thought, right? Because nobody ever has the imagination to see what the next thing is coming. Most recently, maybe stuff like a scanning probe microscopy. No one thought you could possibly feel atoms, for example, and then they did it, right? Or maybe the determining the structure of the human genome. Once you know that, you'll know all diseases, you know how to cure everything and so on. There's a lot of work still to do. But people always are limited in their imagination and think that if you just do what I can see to do now, then we'll be there. Okay? So it started early on. But Lavoisier didn't see it in his time because within 5 years of writing the book, he was guillotined at the age of 50. The judge, Coffinhal, is said to have remarked, "The Republic has no need of geniuses." But in fact, all his equipment was seized for the people, including 80 pounds of mercury. Right, and his wife recovered it. That was during the Reign of Terror. Within a year and a half, it was over, and his wife got the equipment back. And Lagrange said this of Lavoisier: "It took them only an instant to make this head fall, but 100 years may not suffice to reproduce one like it." And that may well be true, but the guys did a lot who followed on from him. Okay, so we've looked at Boyle earlier on in his gas law. Now we've looked at Lavoisier. Now we're going to look at their successors who are 20 or 30 years younger than these guys. Dalton, we're going to talk just a little about Avogadro, but not much. Dalton was an amateur meteorologist. You can see here with some jar to hold gases in. But he lived up in Manchester in Midlands in England, and he kept records of the weather. But he was interested in this question: why do gases of different density in the atmosphere, you know they're different gases, they're nitrogen and oxygen, they have different density. What would you expect if you have two that have different density? Right? Yeah, you expect the heavy one to go down, the light one to go up, but they don't. So people, they can go up to the top of a mountain and measure the composition. It was the same as at the bottom of the atmosphere. So here, notice that in trying to solve that problem, he drew and shown in this picture other things that don't look at all like the atmosphere. Okay? Now, on the continent, the European scientists proposed that different gases attracted one another, so they tend to stay mixed because they're sticking to one another. Okay? But Dalton had a completely different idea. He said the atoms of one kind did not repel the atoms of the other kind. Okay, so here are atoms of what? Nitrogen. And there are the atoms down in the middle. That's his symbol for nitrogen. But they're surrounded by what he called a heat envelope. Right? So you have a certain amount of caloric. Each atom is associated with a certain amount of heat, which he denotes by these lines coming out. Right? And notice the lines from neighboring atoms meet one another. Right? And repel. Right? So there's a match between these lines and therefore repulsion. It's a little bit like the idea of lines of force. Okay? But if you used hydrogen and nitrogen, hydrogen matches hydrogen and repels hydrogen, nitrogen repels nitrogen, but hydrogen and nitrogen don't repel each other, at least not as much, because their lines don't line up. Okay? Now, of course, this is nonsense from our perspective, but this was his idea, and that's what got him thinking about atoms through meteorology. Yeah. They were the heat envelope, he called it, of the atom. Okay, so what he said, instead of opposites attracting, likes were repelling, and that's what tended to keep things mixed. Okay, but then that got him interested in these atoms. And on the basis of atoms, he and others at that time formulated three sort of theorems that had to do with proportions of the weights of these atoms. Definite proportions, equivalent proportions, and multiple proportions. Definite proportions was that pure compounds always have the same weight ratio of their elements. And why would that be consistent with atoms? Because a given compound is a certain ratio of carbon, hydrogen, and so on. No matter where you find it, it's going to have the same ratio of weights of these ultimate elements. Equivalent proportions is a little more complicated. Suppose a weight A of a compound A, or of element A, reacts with a weight B of B. But that same weight of A will react with a certain weight of C. Then in this respect, B parts of B is equivalent to C parts of C. They both react with the same amount of A. Okay? Now suppose you happen to know that a certain amount of D reacts with B parts of B. Then what can you predict? What would you predict about... You've never looked at D reacting with C. But you'll know that if B parts of B equals C parts of C, and D parts of D reacts with B parts of B, it should also react with C parts of C if these proportions are equivalent. Right? So we could predict new compounds, weight ratios of the elements in new compounds, on the assumption that they're made, that all these things are made of acids, of atoms of elements in certain ratios. Okay, and then you have multiple proportions, which is if two elements form several compounds between the same two elements, their weight ratios are related by simple factors. Now let's look at two of these. We've already looked pretty as much as we're going to at equivalent proportions, but let's look at the idea of definite proportions. In France, these guys Berthollet and Proust had different ideas. Are there definite proportions? Berthollet said no, because he was thinking of things like alloys of metals. You can mix metals in many, many ratios, you know, smoothly varying, and get alloys. Or if you look at natural organic materials like oils and so on, you find quite a range of amounts of carbon and hydrogen in them, as we would say, because they're mixtures of many different compounds, right? But Proust said oui, because he was thinking of pure substances, right? So that's what really defined chemistry. After this time, there were people who did practical things like with food chemistry and metallurgy, where they dealt with things that were called Berthollides, right, which didn't have a fixed ratio of the elements. But there were also people who focused their work on pure compounds that always had the same ratio. So those were things that obeyed the law of definite proportion. And it was being able to focus on these things that allowed people to get a foothold in understanding chemistry. So that really defined chemistry, to work with things that obeyed the law of definite proportions, although there certainly were things that didn't obey that law. Okay. Now, multiple proportions. So people were analyzing things like Lavoisier burned charcoal and with water, remember, and got how much carbon and how much oxygen there was in CO2. Right? And also others had analyzed, in CO, carbon monoxide. That was a different experiment, not the one I talked about in 1789. Okay, but then they also analyzed what we now know to be CO2 and found out it was 28% carbon and 72% oxygen by weight. Okay, and then in 1810, they analyzed a Frenchman, Gay-Lussac, analyzed various oxides of nitrogen and found that there was one that was 63.3% nitrogen, another was 44.05, another was 29.5. What do you make out of these numbers? Very nice, right? He did good work. Okay, but if you look at the ratio of the weights, you see that in the first case it's 1.27 and the next 2.57. The ratio of oxygen to nitrogen, 0.58, 1.27, 2.39. Now can you see a pattern? Mike?
They're kind of multiples of each other, so 2.57 is like about double.
Yeah, 2.57 is pretty close to double 1.27. And 1.27 isn't so very far from being double 0.58, and 2.39 is sort of double 1.27, right? They're not exactly, if you define the first one as 1 and see what ratio, then it's 2.02, not 2. It's 2.19 and 4.12. Right, that's about 2, about 2, about 4, right? So integral values are consistent with there being simple ratios of atoms, right? 1 to 1, 1 to 2, 1 to 3, 2 to 3, things like that, right? So this suggested that these atoms were formed, that there were atoms there that were combining in simple ratios. Right. This is the percent error that was in the experiments compared with what we think now. So they were off by between 2 and 10 or 11%. So that's pretty good given what they had at the time. But it took some insight to see these ratios. Right. So great scientists are able to focus on the key factors despite the errors that are there and see what's going to lead to something. Although it's a little bit like the chicken and the egg, right? Do they recognize what's key because they're great? Or do they become great because they had the luck to recognize what was key and it proved to be right, and people that noticed other things turned out to be swept aside? It's an interesting question. At any rate, that's the law of multiple proportions. So we've seen what Lavoisier did, or at least some of what he did. And now we're into elemental analysis as a technique, and the idea of atoms, and what we're getting to now is dualism. And the people we're going to focus on are Betzelius in Sweden and Gay-Lussac in France, in Paris. So here they are. There's Faraday, whom we already talked about a little bit. And here's Betzelius and Gay-Lussac. And we'll also mention Davy, but we won't mention him until after the exam. And remember that today's lecture is not on the exam, but it'll be on the next exam. So here's a picture of Betzelius. 1779 he was born, which is the same year as Silliman, who stands out here. Okay. So what did he do? He did analysis of organic compounds, also of minerals. He analyzed 2,000 compounds in 6 years and did them well. Right? He had developed good atomic weights for 50 elements. Right? He studied electrolysis, which will turn out to be very important, as you'll see. And the idea that came from electrolysis of dualism and of reactions by what's called double decomposition, and we'll talk about what that is. He did a lot of teaching and writing and editing, not lecturing the way I'm teaching you, but teaching people who worked in his lab and editing journals and doing lots of writing. And so you see what he chose as his device for his portrait was the textbook he wrote in 1808. Right? And also, he developed notation for composition, much better, as you'll see, than Dalton's. So let's look at notation for composition and how it developed from alchemy to Dalton to Betzelius. So here are chemical symbols that were in use in Sweden in 1774, all with Latin names, of course. So here's vitriolum cupri, that's copper sulfate. And you'll see that the symbol used for copper is the same one that's the alchemical one that's out on the front of the building. And iron, vitriolum ferri, and there's mercury, and lead, right? And here up at the top is nitrum, which is nitre, okay? So that's the symbol that the alchemists use for nitre, right? And here are the atomic symbols of Dalton. And notice his symbol for nitrogen that we looked for, azot, in that previous thing, is exactly the one that the alchemists use for nitre. Okay. Now here's his table, and notice, and so these are Dalton's symbols. Like, there are various symbols, some of them derived from alchemy, but then here's one with I, Z, C, L, S, P. G in the middle. What did those stand for? Right? They're the English names of the elements. Iron, zinc, copper, lead, silver, platinum, and gold. Right? So if Dalton had won out in the notation game, those are what you'd be writing. Right? But this is what you write. And those were the ones Berzelius used. Right? So here, in Dalton's table, they're binary compounds, right? Diatomic molecules, right? Which here are in Berzelius's corresponding symbols. Now, what was Dalton's logic? He says, when only one combination of two bodies can be obtained, it must be presumed to be a binary one, that is, one to one. So if you only know one compound that has two elements in it, it's got to be one to one in terms of atoms. Right? Unless some other cause appear to the contrary. Okay? If there are, here are ternary compounds, right, with two atoms of one kind and one of the other. Right? He said when two combinations are observed of the same elements, like of N and O, then it must be presumed to be a binary and a ternary. Although how he knew that one was NO2 and not one being N2O and NO is not addressed here. Okay? Okay? When there are three, you have a binary and the other two are ternary. If you know four molecules, then there are two ternary and one quaternary. Right? This is not logically tight, but it's what he assumed. Okay? So anyhow, the notation is Berzelius. And notice how he changed it, how it's different from ours? I mean, you don't recognize these, but you recognize these, except that he used superscripts instead of subscripts. Right? So Berzelius developed the notation that we use, right, in 1811 there. Okay, and notice he used Latin names so it would be international, whereas Dalton had used English names. And that his formulas make no attempt to show structure, how the atoms are arranged. Dalton's have certain arrangements of the atoms, right? Which he had no more basis for knowing than he had for knowing about binary and ternary and so on, right? But Berzelius is only showing the analysis, what the weight ratios are. Okay, and he thought of other abbreviations too. These are other things from Berzelius's book. You see, for example, he could write faster by writing dots for oxygen atoms. So CrO3 was Cr with three dots about it, and KO was K with a dot above it. Or he had these organic acids, and the superscripts denote the number of atoms, like H12C15O3. Incidentally, does that sound right for benzoic acid? In what way is it wrong? It's about twice as big as it ought to be, and the ratios aren't quite right. Because remember, they had to get water out of things, right? So you heat it to get the water out. But suppose you take too much water out, and instead of having the acid, you have the anhydride. Right? That's what he did. Right? So these are actually formulas of anhydride, and they're not quite right. It should be H10C14O3. He's got H12C15O3. So he's close, but not quite right. So the acids were measured as anhydrides. He also had the idea of abbreviating these radicals of the acids with these symbols, but that didn't catch on either. Okay, so how about atom weights and equivalents? I think we'll wait for this next time. Incidentally, I didn't have office hours yesterday, but I'll have office hours today from 2 to 3:30 for those who want to come. Derek?
In this lecture, you said that the very beginning part would be on the exam.
Yeah, but let's not do the beginning. Let's just last lecture, but not this lecture, okay? And, and again, you can come early, those who want to take the exam at a quarter after instead of... Or, it makes no difference to me. If it would be better for you to start at 10 after, that's fine too. Which do you prefer, those who want to come early? Start at 10 after or 15 after?
10 after.
I hear a vote for 10.
15.
I hear votes also for 15, and I've already announced it that way, so I'll keep it that way.
Professor?
Yeah.
I was looking at the 2006 test, and there was a question on Chladni figures. Is that because they were in a different place than us, or should we look that?
Did we do Chladni figures before this exam? I guess we did, huh?
I think.
Yeah, so it's what, since they're fair game, yeah, but they wouldn't be focused on as much as material since the last exam.
Gotcha. Okay.
I actually have questions about that same exam. There was the first question you talked about, like the APS source and the enzyme crystals. I didn't write down the whole question, but did we talk about that? I didn't know what APS source was.
I don't either.
Okay. Okay, I guess then. And then another question is, when you have like a CH2 double bonded to another, yeah, CH2, that would have a high HOMO because it has a double bond, which means four overlap.
Yeah, and also a low LUMO.
It's also low.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and one of them is a little more impressive than the other one.
Okay.
Because it came from p orbitals, not from hybrids, which make most bonds. So both of them are a little bit higher. So the high HOMO is a little more remarkable than low LUMO, but not much.
Okay.
They both react.
Thank you. Okay.